From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Much has happened in the nearly 2 years since a revolution toppled Egypt's longstanding dictator, Hosni Mubarak. Unemployment soared over 12%. A half-baked video ridiculing the Prophet Muhammad sparked violent protests. And in May, the country elected the first Islamist as president in the Arab world, Mohamed Morsi. The candidate of the Muslim Brotherhood has been critical of U.S. policy in the Middle East. And today on the program, we're talking about Egypt after the revolution and what an Islamist government means for the future of Egypt and that country's relationship with the United States. Plus, one man's dedication to the music of Franz Liszt. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The U.S. had a cozy working relationship with Egyptian dictator Hosni Mubarak. That is until his ultimate ouster nearly 2 years ago. Now America's diplomatic corps is negotiating a relationship with Egypt's new leadership, Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. Today on the program, we're talking about the rise of Islamists and Islamist governments and what that means for the future of Egypt and its place in the international community. Joining me in studio is Dr. Tariq Masood. He's an associate professor of public policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. His research focuses on political development in countries that are poor and unfree. And his articles have been published in Foreign Policy, the Journal of Democracy, and other publications. He's the author of a forthcoming book on Islamic political parties and the Muslim Brotherhood. And Dr. Masood, welcome. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
Dr. Masood presents the lecture Understanding Muslim Societies tonight, Tuesday, November 13th at 7 o'clock in the Gore Concert Hall at Westminster College. We'll give you more details on that as we go. Later on in the show, acclaimed concert pianist Leslie Howard. But first, the future of Egypt. If you've got questions or comments about what an Islamist government is, what it means for the Egyptian people, or for the country's economy, or for U.S. foreign policy in the region, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Before we get to the region, Dr. Masood, tell us about your background. What's your interest in Egypt?
Again, thanks for having me. As you can tell by my name, I was born in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. my parents are actually from Egypt, and I grew up between the United States and Saudi Arabia. And so I've always been interested in the politics of this part of the world that my parents are from and that I lived in for several years. And so when I came back here for college and then graduate school, I always felt that I wanted to do something that would help me understand this part of the world and help other people understand this part of the world. So that's sort of how I came to the study of the Middle East, even though my parents wanted me to be a doctor.
Of course. So, yeah. there is a lot of unknowns out there. We don't know a lot in mainstream America what is going on in Egypt. So refresh our memories. The U.S. relationship pre-revolution, what was it like with Egypt?
Yeah. So, Egypt is, as everybody listening probably knows, is the biggest Arab country, about 80, 85 million people, and it's the most central Arab country in terms of its cultural leadership, its political leadership. Almost every political ideology that has gripped the Arabs over the last 75 years has come out of Egypt. So this is a very important country. And it used to be a protectorate of Britain, of Great Britain. And in the 1950s, Great Britain's role was diminished. There was a military coup in 1952. The British were eventually pushed out. And for several years, Egypt was actually, during the Cold War, was actually kind of allied with the Soviet Union. So Egypt was not a friend of ours. And its first or its leader at that time was a man named Gamal Abdel Nasser, as you probably know him here. And he was not a friend of the United States at all. He was anti-Western hegemony. He felt that the West was trying to exert control over Arab peoples. And his political project was sort of a mixture of socialism and Arab nationalism. So Egypt was not America's friend at that time. And it's only after Nasser died in 1970 and he was succeeded by a man named Anwar Sadat that the relationship began to change, because Sadat was a very clever guy. And he sort of put his finger to the wind, and he realized that the United States was a far better ally to have, a far better patron for a developing country like Egypt than the Soviet Union was. And his sort of evidence for this was Egypt's wars with Israel, right, where, you know, in 1956 and 1967, by then, the United States had been, Israel had been able to count on American assistance, particularly in 67, and the Soviet assistance to Egypt paled in comparison. So he wanted to refocus Egypt and recenter it more firmly in the American camp, and that's what he did. And that Egyptian-American alliance lasted up until the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak in January 2011.
The Obama administration, I mean, the relationship changed quite dramatically with the president. He seemed to sympathize with the protesters who were at Tahrir Square. And I think this kind of caught the establishment, the Egyptian establishment, off guard a bit.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think that I think the Egyptian establishment could not fathom that the United States would potentially let go of as staunch and as steadfast an ally as Hosni Mubarak. But, of course, Obama came out of a different kind of environment. You know, he was not a Washington insider. So he, you know, for example, contrast Obama with his own vice president, Joe Biden, who called Mubarak a friend and who said that I wouldn't call Mubarak a dictator, and Hillary Clinton, his secretary of state, who called the Mubaraks her friends. And so Obama comes out of a very different place. For him, Mubarak is just an aging autocrat, not a terribly interesting guy. And why should the United States be investing in him? So I think Obama was well positioned to kind of break that relationship. The irony, of course, is that the youth in Tahrir Square, the revolutionaries with whom Obama sympathized, they don't see it this way. They think that the United States dragged its feet and took unconscionably long to side with the protesters, and only did so after it became apparent that the protesters were going to win. So so it's not as if Obama's gotten a whole lot of credit for that move.
So revolution. Protesters win. Mubarak is out. Okay, here we are. There's economic uncertainty. Unemployment is sky high. Where did the Egyptians find themselves after they ousted their leader?
Yeah, I think Egyptians found themselves in a very difficult position. They obviously, as you know, one of the drivers of the revolution was the fact that the economy was not doing as well as people wanted it to. It was not generating the opportunity for young people in particular. Even though there was actually pretty decent economic growth, there was a sense that the benefits of this growth were not evenly distributed. And after the revolution, it's, you know, obviously revolutions are difficult. These economic problems were not solved overnight. And as you say, right, revolutions introduce uncertainty. So in the short term, their economic effect is almost always going to be bad, right? Investors don't want to put money in countries that have just had revolutions. But that doesn't mean the revolution wasn't necessary and, or won't in the long term be good. So as you note, Egypt is continuing to struggle. Its foreign reserves are continuing to dwindle. The Egyptian pound is getting weaker. Egyptian citizens are finding their purchasing power is less. And the Egyptian government today realizes that it actually has, it's facing a huge budget deficit. And there's lots of things that the Egyptian government spends on that it can't afford to spend on anymore. So, for example, the Egyptian government subsidizes bread for people, right? And this costs billions. And it is a kind of cornerstone of the social contract between the government and the people. It's so difficult to remove this subsidy that even Mubarak didn't try to do it. The last person who tried to do it was Anwar Sadat in 1977, and there were riots, and so he backed off. And today, the Egyptian government, now led by Mohamed Morsi, is realizing that they need to do something with this. They need to reduce these subsidies. There's also petrol subsidies that overwhelmingly benefit more affluent people as opposed to poor people. So there's these huge economic pressures. The Egyptian government has to deal with it, but if they deal with them, they'll face an even greater political backlash. So I think that the economic picture is very bad, and you know it's going to be bad for some time. The Egyptian government now is trying to negotiate a big loan with the International Monetary Fund to tide it over. And again, some people understand that this is necessary. Other people say the International Monetary Fund is an agent of Western imperialism, and we don't want to have anything to do with them. And somebody like Mohamed Morsi is in a real tough bind.
We're going to talk about Mohamed Morsi in a moment. Yeah. We're speaking with Tariq Masood. He's an associate professor of public policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's presenting a lecture tonight, Understanding Muslim Societies, Tuesday, November 13th at 7 o'clock in the Gore Concert Hall at Westminster College. That's 1840 South, 1300 East here in Salt Lake City. The lecture, sponsored by the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy, is free and open to the public. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Tell us, who is Mohamed Morsi, the new president of Egypt?
Yes. Well, Mohamed Morsi is... it's sort of he's a very interesting guy. I will say that when I wrote my dissertation I began writing it in 2005. Actually, Mohamed Morsi was one of the main people that I focused on in my dissertation. I spent a lot of time with him.
Stroke of luck for you.
Yeah. Seriously, I don't think I capitalized on it as much as I could have. But Morsi was running for re-election at that time. He was a parliamentarian. He was like equivalent of a congressman from a district in a largely rural district in the eastern part of Egypt. Mohamed Morsi actually got his PhD in materials engineering from the University of Southern California. He's somebody who's actually spent a lot of time in the United States. If I had to define his sort of political ideology, I'd say it's like this very strong Egyptian nationalism coupled with religious conservatism and a big dose of anti-Americanism. This is somebody who, in almost every political speech I've ever heard him give, going all the way back to 2005, who focuses inordinately on the United States and what he sees as the decadence of the United States and things like that. So this is the guy who is now Egypt's president. It was sort of surprising to a lot of people that he was the president. It wasn't surprising that the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate would win. It was just surprising that he would be the candidate. And of course, as you know, and your viewers may know, he was actually not even the first choice. The Muslim Brotherhood had picked one of its big financiers to run. That person turned out to be disqualified on a legal technicality, and so their backup option was Mohamed Morsi, who's, like I said, seen as very conservative, very tough. He's a kind of gruff individual.
He's the candidate for the Muslim Brotherhood. Tell us what that party stands for.
Yes.
What's their platform and ideology?
Yes. Oh, thank you. Yeah. So the Muslim Brotherhood is this religious social movement that began in Egypt in 1928. And it's what's 1928? What's the significance of 1928? Well, that's only 4 years after the collapse of the caliphate, which was this sort of pan-Islamic government that was centered in the Ottoman Empire. Now, of course, it wasn't very powerful or strong by that point, but there was this symbol called the caliph, who was the leader of all Muslims. And in 1924, that ends. And so this was a tremendously traumatic event for lots of Muslims, including for the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, who establishes this organization both to resurrect the caliphate and to get the West out of the Middle East. Remember, at this time, Egypt is dominated by the British. So this movement starts in 1928. It grows very rapidly. And in fact, by the early 1950s, on the eve of the 1952 coup that unseated Egypt's king at the time, the Muslim Brotherhood was a very powerful force, and it was actually allied with the coup leaders. Then Nasser, who moved Egypt into a kind of Soviet orbit, he cracked down on the Brotherhood, and the Brotherhood remained underground for several years until, in the middle of the 1970s, Sadat starts to allow them to become active again, and they basically become a kind of political party. by the 1980s, they're running in elections. They're highly conservative. They want the constitution to conform to Islamic law. They want there to be less sexuality on television. They want there to be more censorship of the media. They want, they want basically social and political institutions to conform with this religious ideology. This is what Mohamed Morsi comes out of. This is the movement that he comes out of. And you know, in terms of its membership in Egypt, I'd put it at about 500,000 members. They, after the revolution, they actually formed a formal political party, so a political wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's called the Freedom and Justice Party. I mean, just look at that party's name, Freedom and Justice, right? They're saying that's what we want.
But I'm wondering when Egyptians finally had the chance to elect a leader, why? Why did they turn to the Muslim Brotherhood? What was the attraction there?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I'm not sure people... I think there are multiple answers, all of which are correct. Okay, so lots of times you'll hear people tell you that the Egyptians voted for the Muslim Brotherhood because the Muslim Brotherhood bought their votes with, chickens and bags of rice. And, that's probably part of it. But lots of other political parties and candidates have tried to do things like that and have not succeeded. And I think you can't escape the fact that if you survey Egyptians and you ask them, what kind of society do you want? What role do you want for the Sharia, the Islamic law? The vast majority of Egyptians say that they want the laws of their country to conform with the Holy Book. Okay. So the Muslim Brotherhood and other religious parties are coming along and saying, this is what we want to do. And that, I think, is highly legitimate with people. I mean, it's a fairly simple explanation. It may change. It may be after 4 years when the economy doesn't pick up, people will say, well, maybe we need people who have a more robust vision for the economy. But right now, I think that feature of the Muslim Brotherhood's political program was clearly attractive to folks. And then, there are all kinds of other things, too, but such as the fact that the other parties, the liberal parties, didn't get their act together in time. But again, you can't escape this deep popular belief that the political Islamic program is something legitimate and should be tried.
Speaking with Dr. Tariq Masood, an associate professor of public policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's speaking tonight, Tuesday, November 13th at 7 o'clock, on the topic Understanding Muslim Societies. That's happening in the Gore Concert Hall at Westminster College, 1840 South, 1300 East here in Salt Lake City. The lecture is free and open to the public. And if you'd like to join us, we're talking about the future of Egypt after the revolution and the rise of Islamist governments. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. We do need to take a break. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking about the rise of Islamist governments, and in particular, the Egyptian case study. In May, Egyptians elected Mohamed Morsi as their president, making him the first Islamist head of state in the Arab world. With harsh rhetoric toward the U.S. and lukewarm condemnation of attacks on American embassies, Morsi's leadership and his agenda remain a bit puzzling for those in the West. Today on the program, we're talking about the rise of Islamists, and if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. With me in studio, Dr. Tariq Masood, an associate professor of public policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He'll be speaking tonight at Westminster College. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But if you have questions about what you think U.S. foreign policy should look like with Egypt, or why do you think Egyptians elected an Islamist head of state, what kind of statement were they trying to send to the U.S. and the world? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Dr. Masood, I want to read the lead paragraph from an article that appeared in Britain's Telegraph newspaper back in September. They reported in interviews on the eve of his departure for the United Nations General Assembly in New York, the Egyptian president gave an uncompromising critique of U.S. policies in the Middle East, underscoring his growing reputation as figurehead of a new, democratic, defiant, and often Islamist Arab world. Do you agree with this assessment that Mohamed Morsi is the face of the new Islamist world?
Well, certainly I would say that's the case. I mean, he's the face of Egypt as Egypt's president, and to the extent that he is the first member of the Muslim Brotherhood to become head of state in any country, I think he's absolutely the face of that movement now. The question is whether that movement is, stands unequivocally for, in opposition to the United States and in opposition to the West, et cetera. And I think certainly Mohamed Morsi, his sort of political orientation, as I noted earlier, he is very much a critic of the United States, of its role in the region, of its support for Israel. And so I think that he is, and sort of personally, he's a kind of, as I said, he's a kind of fighting personality, right? If you look at videos of him when he was on the floor of Parliament from 2000 to 2005, he wasn't reelected, but he was always getting into fights with Mubarak's ministers and, yelling at them, and there were even ad hominem attacks. I mean, this is a really tough individual. So it's not surprising to me that his discourse about the United States would be gruff and tough and a little bit confrontational. So the question is now, is when Mohamed Morsi says things about the United States, is he speaking as Mohamed Morsi? Is he speaking as a representative of the Muslim Brotherhood? Or is he really vocalizing the feelings of the entire Egyptian people and maybe even the entire Arab nation? And it's hard to escape the conclusion that the latter is the correct one. I mean, again, if you look at you survey people, and we've done a lot of surveys in Egypt over the past 2 years, you find that people are generally very critical of the United States. Now, they don't necessarily want the relationship with the United States to deteriorate, okay? Because they realize, look, the United States is the world's number one power. We don't want to make the great power angry. But at the same time, they need to respect us, and they need to know not to take us for granted. This is what I think the Egyptian people feel. And so I think, in large part, Mohamed Morsi is vocalizing a lot of those feelings.
There was this video you may have heard mm-hmm. of, that a very amateurish video that mm-hmm. sparked violent protests throughout the Middle East and throughout the Muslim world when it was mocking the Prophet Muhammad. There was not real strong condemnation on the part of Mohamed Morsi, at least at first. Why do you think that is?
So you're saying there's not strong condemnation from Morsi for the attack on the embassy that resulted from
that? Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think in part it's very hard for any political candidate or politician who represents a movement called the Muslim Brotherhood to look in a lukewarm fashion on any insult of the Prophet. I mean, this is their bread and butter. They cannot afford to be seen as being soft on the defense of the Prophet of Islam, especially since they would likely be outflanked by a lot of political forces in Egypt who would, beat their chests and say, "We defend the Prophet's honor, and how come Mohamed Morsi is not doing the same thing?" So I think he was put in a tough position.
It leaves a lot of people in the West kind of, what's going on here?
No, absolutely.
You live in a free society, are you used to people criticizing belief systems?
And yes.
It doesn't always spark such violence.
Well, as I wrote in Slate during the height of that crisis, if the health of the Egyptian-American relationship is going to rely on no American ever doing or saying anything that ever offends the religious sensibilities of Egyptians, then we're not going to be able to be friends for much longer because, as you know, this is a free society. We insult every religion. Just, look at South Park. So I tend to think that somebody like Mohamed Morsi is sophisticated enough to know that. And what he and I think the Muslim Brotherhood have tried to do is they've tried to have it both ways. They've tried to make it clear that they are on the side of those who would defend the Prophet's honor. But at the same time, they have said we have an Islamic responsibility to protect the lives and property of the envoys of other countries in our in Egypt, and therefore attacks on the embassy are not allowed. And so he's tried to have it both ways. And I think in general, on balance, if you were to ask Egyptians, you know, did the Muslim Brotherhood or did Mohamed Morsi support these protests? I think on balance, the Egyptians would recognize that Mohamed Morsi was not a full-throated supporter of these protests and of these insults against the American embassy, that in fact the Muslim Brotherhood didn't really want that to happen, but they were trapped once they did.
Yet in your Slate article, you do call it a clash of civilizations.
Well, I regret that. I wasn't calling it a clash of civilizations. I was saying that, you know, somebody looking at this could say, yep, Sam Huntington, the Harvard professor who came up with this notion that civilizations, the Muslim civilization, the Western civilization, the Chinese civilization, would eventually find themselves into conflict. Somebody would look at what happened with the embassy attack in Benghazi or the protests in Egypt, and they would say, this is a clash of civilizations. It's happening right here. And my argument was that there's nothing inevitable about that. If politicians behave like adults, okay, like American politicians have been behaving, at least when it comes to Egypt, if you look at how Hillary Clinton responded to, you know, the pelting of her motorcade with tomatoes when she was in Egypt, or the way we respond to a lot of outrageous things that Egyptian politicians say about America, we behave in a fairly adult and tolerant way. And I think it's obviously Egyptian politicians can do the same thing, but they're going to need to do the same thing for this relationship to remain preserved and to stave off this kind of civilizational clash. Mm.
Speaking with Dr. Tariq Masood, Associate Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He'll be speaking tonight at Westminster College at 7 o'clock. 801-355-TALK is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking about the future of Egypt post-revolution. 801-355-8255. Let's go to Jeff in Salt Lake City. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, go right ahead.
I happen to feel that separation of church and state is one of the principles of democracy. And this Arab Spring that's been, you know, happening throughout the Middle East has seemed like a populist democratic movement, but has resulted in actually establishments of regimes that contradict the principles of separation of religion and state, so to say. And I just have a question. You seem to be very cozy with the idea of the vast majority of Muslims or people in Egypt supporting this Sharia law, but what about the Coptic Christians and the basic principles of protecting the rights of minority despite the electorate of a majority government that is contradictory to the principles of democracy?
Hmm. Jeff, it's a good point. Dr. Masood.
Yeah, I absolutely reject and object to your characterization of me being cozy with the belief that state policy should follow Sharia. I'm relaying to you what polling data says, and it's important for people who think about this to know exactly what Egyptian popular opinion is. We can't put our heads in the sand or make some kind of grand statement to them that, oh, this is against principles of separation of church and state. Well, this is what people believe. It doesn't mean it's legitimate, but this is what we have to deal with.
But to Jeff's point, I mean, can you have a functioning democracy when it is...
The Queen of England is the head of the Church of England, and she is the head of state. There are a variety of European countries that don't have this principle of separation of church and state. You can look at Scandinavian countries, for example, where the Lutheran Church is actually an established church. The question is now, to come back to the important issue that the caller raised, the position of Coptic Christians. Coptic Christians in Egypt are between 5 and 10% of the Egyptian population. This is a very old Christian community. The word Copt has the same etymological root as the word for Egypt. My parents are from Egypt. There is almost no doubt that back in our history, we were all Christians before we converted to Islam. So this is a very deeply Egyptian Christian community, and they rightly rightly feel that developments in Egypt are moving in a direction that are excluding them from equal citizenship. And so the question is, how do we deal with that? Now, I don't think that democracy as in and of itself actually is opposed to the fusion of church and state. Democracy is basically elections, the rule of the majority, and there's nothing in that that prevents majorities from voting for more religion in their public life. What really limits that is liberalism, right? This belief in the inviolability of the individual. Okay, and that fundamental—that's a belief that I have. It's a belief that lots of Americans have. It is unfortunately not a belief that lots of people, lots of Egyptians have, or I'd even argue other non-Western peoples have. It's almost a fundamentally religious belief. This idea that individuals should be free to do whatever they want as long as they don't harm anybody else. Well, somebody else could say to you, "No, I don't think that rights accrue to individuals. Rights should accrue to communities. That we should protect the sanctity of the community as opposed to the sanctity of the individual." So absolutely, if an individual does something, even if it's not harming others in a direct sense, if it's lewd morally, it's harming the community, and we should restrict that. That is an alternative worldview that lots of people around the world share, and I would argue that I think lots of people in Egypt share. And so how do we deal with that, right? Because making liberals out of Egyptians is, or out of lots of different nationalities, that is a long process. And so here's the way that Egyptians and Islamists, let me talk about Islamists in particular, not Egyptians. Here's the way that Islamists respond to the argument that Coptic Christians do badly under an Islamic regime. They will come back to you and say, no. We're putting an article in our constitution that says that Coptic Christians and Jews, they will be governed in matters of personal status by their own religious laws. So if you're a Christian, you don't need to worry that the Sharia is going to apply to you when it comes to divorce or, you know, you're going to be governed by the law of your church, okay? And that, to the religious Islamist, seems like a perfectly workable solution.
Is that happening in practice?
Yeah, they're putting it in the Constitution. My argument is that that's horrible, okay? I mean, again, because I have this fundamentally religious commitment to this idea of liberalism, when you put an article in the Constitution that says, hey, I as a Muslim am going to be governed by my Sharia, and you as a Christian can be governed by your law, what you're doing is you are dividing and separating people, and you are making an argument that what matters in Egypt are not individuals but communities, right? And so you then, in fact, are subjecting the individual Christian to the tyranny of his church. Maybe he doesn't want to be governed by a church.
Jeff, what do you think?
Yeah, but I agree with that point. I seem to agree with his point of view. I mean, you will discriminate against plenty of people who aren't religious in any way.
Exactly.
If you put everybody under some religious law, that is absolutely right, and it is discriminatory. And so I oppose that. But the fundamental problem I have in comparing the Western religious or the Western governments as not having separation of church and state with the Middle East governments is that you don't really have a follow-on to democracy after you establish an Islamic government through a democratic revolution, as we've seen in Iran. Do you expect that Egypt will ever have another democratic election now that they have an Islamic government in charge? Or will they simply convert their democracy to a Sharia law-based government?
That's a good question. I think that Egypt is very, and other countries like Tunisia, for example, has also had elections that brought Islamists to a plurality. I think that those countries are very different from Iran in the way that their religious actors are structured and the strength of those religious actors. So in Iran, remember, the guys who eventually took over are the clergy, and the clergy have an enormous amount of power, legitimacy. The Muslim Brotherhood, even though it is a fairly highly organized political movement, doesn't enjoy anywhere near the kind of legitimacy that the mullahs in Iran enjoyed with their people. I mean, it's after all a political party. Lots of people who voted for it now wouldn't vote for it in the future. And in fact, we've done polls on this. So I think that, it may absolutely be the case that if you took a Muslim Brotherhood leader, injected him with truth serum and said, hey, would you rather have democracy or unending Muslim Brotherhood rule? They would absolutely tell you they would rather have unending Muslim Brotherhood rule. The question is, can they get that? And I think that it's much harder for them to do that because they don't control the military. They don't control the police. I mean, if they tried to abrogate or subvert democracy, I think there would be massive protests of the kind that unseated Hosni Mubarak, and the Brotherhood wouldn't really be able to quell them. So I think that they understand this. So I'm not worried about a Muslim Brotherhood dominion. Here's what I am worried about. I am worried that secular and liberal parties in Egypt, having observed these tremendous electoral victories by Islamists, will say, you know what, man, we need to change our political discourse. We need to have a little bit more religion in our political discourse in order to win votes. And that may be fine. I mean, we find a very much milder but analogous dynamic here in the United States. But the question is, how far would it go in Egypt?
Jeff, thanks for the call. I want to sneak in one last call. Israr calling from Salt Lake City. Israr, hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thank you. Be very brief, if you would.
Well, congratulations for a good program.
Thank you.
I would like to suggest that we are a mature democracy in America, but look at the history. Throughout the last 70 years, Western democracies had sought stability and dictatorship, for that matter. Now we need to let the fledgling democracies prosper and not expect them to act as a very mature democracy, which we are in America, you know. And that was my point, really.
Israr, thank you so much. I guess that leads me to my final question. And again, Professor Massoud, I apologize. We're very short on time. But what does all of this mean for U.S. foreign policy and our relationship with Egypt going forward?
Yeah, I think that thank you, for Israr, for your question. I think your question, Jennifer, is a great one to end on. I think, look, it's clear that America has a much tougher road to hoe in the Middle East than it had during the Mubarak era or during the era of unchallenged Arab dictatorship, where these regimes could basically do whatever we wanted them to do without fear of public opinion. Now that's a lot harder. And so from the United States standpoint, it's going to mean that policies are going to be a little bit tougher. They're not going to be as cooperative. The question is, what are we looking at long term? And I think if we understand that the main challenge in all of these countries is we've got some democratic procedures. What we really want now in those countries is genuine pluralism, where it's not just Islamists or one group that dominates politics. And if we get pluralism in these places, it may be very messy. You may have secular parties who hate America every bit as much as the Salafists do. But I think overall that will be better for the United States dealing with sort of pluralistic democracies. And so we have to keep our eyes on that prize, even though in the short term it might mean a lot of heartburn for our policy.
Dr. Tariq Massoud, Associate Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He'll be speaking tonight, Understanding Muslim Societies, Tuesday, November 13th at 7 o'clock in the Gore Concert Hall at Westminster College, 1840 South, 1300 East here in Salt Lake City. The lecture is sponsored by the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy, and it's free and open to the public. Dr. Massoud, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
Coming up next, the music of Franz Liszt. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Dr. Leslie Howard is a renowned pianist in his own right, performing recitals and concerto performances with many of the world's great orchestras and conductors. But he's likely best known for his work recording the challenging piano compositions of the man many regard as the greatest pianist of his time, the prolific composer Franz Liszt. Today on the program, we're talking with Leslie Howard about his fascination with and his dedication to the Liszt repertoire. And Dr. Leslie Howard is in studio with me, nursing a cold. Thank you so much for your time and welcome. He's an acclaimed concert pianist, and he has best known for his recordings of the complete piano music of Franz Liszt. That project put Leslie Howard in the Guinness Book of World Records for the largest recording project ever undertaken by a solo musician. And also joining me in studio, a name and a voice that you'll certainly recognize, Gene Pack. He founded Classical Music Radio in Utah and was on the air with KUER for 40 years. And he's the recipient of the Madeline Award in the Humanities, also a well-known actor in Salt Lake City. And Gene Pack, it's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Dr. Leslie Howard performs a solo recital tomorrow, Wednesday, November 14th at 7:30 p.m. at the Cathedral Church of St. Mark. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join our conversation, if you appreciate the music of Franz Liszt, if you are a fan of Leslie Howard, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. I know your voice is shot, but I'm going to give you this question anyway. Leslie Howard, why? Why Liszt? Why Franz Liszt?
Apart from that I fell in love with this music, it was really that other composers I'd fallen in love with had a lot of people fighting for them already. You know, there was no shortage of people playing Beethoven and Mozart and Schubert and Schumann. And Liszt, nobody had really dug deep to see what there was. And I was astonished to find out how much there was. And I found even more as I went on making the records. And Liszt's output for the piano is greater in quantity than Schubert, Schumann, Chopin, Mendelssohn, Brahms, and Beethoven added up. It's just an amazing amount of work. Mm-hmm. And he was indefatigable at it. His composing life ran from when he was 10 until just a couple of weeks short of his death at 75. So, and he worked 6 hours a day solidly at his desk every morning. At 6 o'clock he got up. And he just, you know, was tireless.
Hmm.
And so inventive. And people just don't know most of it. So I've had a lot of fun. And I'm happy to say that it's had a couple of good effects. One is that the new Liszt edition coming out of Hungary has printed a lot of music that was otherwise not available because people have been writing and saying, excuse me, I've got Howard's record of it. Why isn't it in your edition? And then other pianists now are not just playing the usual 20 pieces that kids used to learn, but they're venturing a bit further afield. So I'm really delighted about that too.
As I mentioned, I mean, you hold the record for the largest recording project ever undertaken by a solo musician, more than 300 world premieres, unpublished manuscripts, and works that have not been heard since Liszt was alive.
Well, some of them probably weren't even heard then, except in the privacy of his own chamber, because he didn't play any of his music in public after he turned 35. He gave up the concert platform and, with about three exceptions, never went back near it.
Hmm. Gene Pack, how would you characterize Leslie Howard's achievement?
Oh, well, words like stupendous seem to come to mind. No one has ever done this. He is rightly in the Guinness Book of World Records because there are how many? 90 how many?
99.
CDs, each of which has about an hour and 15 or 20 minutes on it. And that is a staggering achievement just to have done it. How long did it take you, Leslie?
The main bulk was done in 14 years, but I was still collecting all sorts of manuscripts. And so I've made four supplementary discs, getting it from 95 to 99.
Uh-huh.
And I think before I die, I will probably have enough material to record the 100th.
Oh, you've got to.
Well, there's one big piece that we're looking for, which is in private hands, and it was bought anonymously.
Oh.
And no one knows where it is, but it's something that he wrote when he was quite young, but I've seen some pages of it because I helped identify it for Sotheby's Auction House in London. And it got sold for a prodigious sum of money. You know, like we 1.5 houses in London to buy this manuscript. And, you know, the British Library really should have paid for it.
But I suspect if anyone can find this, it's you, Leslie
Well,
Howard.
I'm trying to get it tracked down. And if I get it done, then we'll have Disc 100.
Oh. We're speaking with Leslie Howard, the acclaimed concert pianist. He returns to Salt Lake City for a solo recital tomorrow, Wednesday, November 14th at 7:30 at the Cathedral Church of St. Mark, 231 East 1st South here in Salt Lake City. Tickets are $15. They are available at the door, and you can find more information on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, if you've got questions about Leslie Howard's work and his monumental achievements concerning the music of Franz Liszt, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Let's go to the phones, and Frank is joining us from Salt Lake City. Frank, hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Go right ahead.
Say, I was wondering, did Franz Liszt compose the piano tune Chopsticks?
I can promise you he did not.
No.
He did not?
No. He did make an arrangement of a piano piece by a Russian composer called Dago Mishki, which was loosely based on it. And he also made a little prelude to a polka by Borodin, which was also based on it, but he certainly didn't write it.
I see. I heard once he not only that he did, but the manuscript for that tune was thrown overboard on a ship.
It's amazing how many legends spring up out of nowhere.
I think
Frank,
it was
a man
named Cherepnin who generally gets the...
Well, there you go, Frank. There you go.
But he just did the orchestration. We can't make him guilty of writing the tune.
Frank, thank you so much for the call. 801-355-TALK. We're speaking with Leslie Howard, the pianist. We've been talking too much. I want to listen to some of your music. You've brought in a CD. Can you tell us what we'll be listening to? Gene Pack?
Oh, this is one of the pieces on the program, and one that I am particularly looking forward to, because Leslie has played it several times, and it is a delight.
And it is titled?
It's a fantasy on themes from Don Giovanni and The Marriage of Figaro, two of Mozart's great operas, and he kind of links them together in the piece.
And this is the pianist, Leslie Howard. Leslie Howard, you hear that. I mean, that's texture to it.
Well, I'm sorry, we seem to be having a little technical problem.
We do seem to be having some technical issues. That we're not doing it justice here, but clearly you have such a facility with the Liszt language.
Oh.
Well, you got to love it. once you love it, then you treat it right. If you treat it with respect, what goes wrong with Liszt when it's played by a lot of young pianists?
Yeah.
Is that they try to use him as a vehicle to show off, and then Liszt's music sounds cheap and nasty, which it isn't. If you treat him with the same respect that you treat the Beethoven sonatas, then you'll produce some decent music making.
And that's what you do, you know? Haven't you been called the Klemperer of the piano?
Oh, dear. Yes.
I thought you were proud of that. You should be.
What does that mean, Gene?
Oh, well, Otto Klemperer was a very great conductor who specialized in the symphonies of Beethoven and all kinds of weighty things. And this is a terrific compliment to Leslie, to be compared and called the Klemperer of the piano.
Mm. We only have a few seconds left. I want to leave us with a selection you'll be playing tonight from Rachmaninoff. But Leslie Howard, I mean, when you have done what you have done, what is there left to do?
There's lots of music I still need to play. And I like to play a lot of chamber music. I like to play a lot of concertos. And I will never undertake another project of that kind. because it took my life over for a very long time. But I'm still busy trying to publish all of his unpublished works.
Ah, good.
And I'm writing a thematic catalog. And
I mean, there isn't another project of that size around.
Not unless maybe the complete works of Czerny.
Oh, Lord. No, I think Liszt is much, much worse. There's Liszt on the program tomorrow night, and there's Rachmaninoff, and there's Beethoven, a wonderful piece called the Eroica Variations. So it's a very rewarding concert, musically and, of course, virtuosically, with Leslie at the piano.
Leslie Howard performing in a solo recital tomorrow, Wednesday, November 14th at 7:30 at the Cathedral Church of St. Mark here in Salt Lake City. More information at kcpw.org. Gentlemen, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, and apologies for the voice.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.